You are listening to the sermon podcast of Connection Church, a gospel-centered community on a mission to make much of Jesus in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. For more information, visit SiouxFallsConnection.com. Thank you for listening.
Matthew is the first book in the New Testament, the first of the four Gospels. That is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That word gospel simply means good news, the good news of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus as told by these eyewitnesses. And we find ourselves in the very last chapter. That is, up to this point, Jesus has been betrayed. He's been abandoned. He's been in a great miscarriage of justice, falsely accused, and now executed, died. He's then buried then in a borrowed tomb. And we find that there were a couple of women who were there who saw him all the way to the end. We'll be reintroduced to them again, even in this chapter. And we've arranged it such that we get ourselves in verse 1 of chapter 28 on Happy Jesus is Alive Day. So I want to, as it were, pick up where we've left off, and I'll begin in verse 1 of chapter 28. Now, after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid. For I know that you seek Jesus, who was crucified. He is not here. For he is risen, as he said. Come, see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he's risen from the dead. And behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. See, I have told you." So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me." While they were going, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, "Tell people, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So they took the money and did as they were directed. And this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. I was speaking several years ago with a good friend and mentor, a pastor friend of mine. And it was the week that he was to preach on Easter, Holy Week. And his youngest son was about 11, and his son, knowing that he was going to have a day off from school on Good Friday, came to his dad and wanting to do something, asked his dad, hey, do you have to work on Friday? Because after all, he wanted to go do something fun with his father, and he kind of went to his dad, you know, hoping that they could have some get-together, do some fun stuff. And my friend, his father, said to him, "Well, I have a little bit of work to do to write my sermon for Sunday." And the 11-year-old said to his father, "It's Easter. Everyone already knows what's going to happen. Just tell the story and, you know, add a little sparkle." And so, this is great wisdom for me. This is a great help for me. As we've been walking through the Gospel of Matthew, we've been invited to rest in and take joy in and find hope and comfort from the finished work of Jesus. What Jesus has accomplished and finished changes everything for us. And I don't want you to be so far removed from the celebration of Christmas that you miss out on the gift that we celebrate in Jesus, a gift, right? You don't have to buy a gift. You don't have to earn a gift. Instead, you just open it, unwrap it, and enjoy it. And so too also, that's us. We tell the story, and you'll see, Matthew provides the sparkle. So, beginning in verse 1, "Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb." There's a whole lot going on here. There's a lot of powerful things happening. In the end, the most, I think, pivotal phrase in this entire passage is the angels saying to them, "He's not here. He's not here. He's risen." If you want to remember anything from today, that's it. He's not here. You're not going to find him. He's alive. He's risen. Go. He will go ahead of you and he will meet you. Go and tell. We'll spend a lot of time next week talking through the go and tell part, you see, from beginning to end in this chapter. But we believe that Jesus and his resurrection changes everything. And you'll see even a couple of those things in that first verse. It says, after the Sabbath. Now, that would have been the seventh day, right? What we know as Saturday. They were there then at the dawn of the first day of the week. That's Sunday. Now, this is especially important to point out. And there's two things I think I would point out. Number one, especially for you in the room, maybe if you were kind of raised in a highly religious background, you know how religious folk love change. And something took place on this particular Sunday morning such that a religious tradition that had lasted thousands of years, namely to gather together and celebrate the goodness of what God had done for them, all of a sudden swapped. Just switch days from Saturday to Sunday, right? Right. Imagine that, you religious folk. If we were like, hey, we're going to get together on Tuesday mornings from now on. And you'd be like, I think I have things planned. Right, exactly. That's exactly what we see here. We're invited to see that the resurrection changed everything. Notice also, it changed even the way we understand the world. It changes even, mind you, not just the day that this kind of religious gathering takes place, but it changes how you measure time. Let me give you the example I think that stands out to me. If you ever get to meet a person who has just recently had a child, say in the last year or two, this illustration will make sense. Something has happened to them and they're not even able to tell time normally. Here's what I mean. You tell a person, like you meet a person who has a child and you say, oh, this is an adorable little child. How old is this child? And they will say something ridiculous. They'll say something like, 19 months. Like 19 months. Nobody counts that way. That's not a thing. And yet, notice what's happened. Something so monumental has taken place in their life, they count time differently. Now maybe they're just holding on to that special moment of when that child was born, and so they're carrying it out for I don't know how. At a certain point we're like, "Hey, we can't count this child life in months. We have to switch to years like the rest of the world, right?" But notice, every single time you look at a calendar, you'll see, even this year, it's 2024, and it begs the question, what? 2024, what? 2024 years since what? You get the idea? Something took place here so monumental that it changed the way the known world even counted time, right? Like in the same way that having a child changed the way a young set of parents counts time, so also something interrupted history. It changed this religious practice from Saturday to Sunday, as we gather now, the New Testament says here, on the Lord's Day, and it testifies to the power of what they witnessed. And so also, every single time you look at a calendar and see those last numbers, you see the powerful significance of what these women encountered. So, here's what I think we see. The resurrection shows us how God can use barriers as props. Here's what I mean. Look what happened next. Behold, I think I've shared this in the whole of the Gospel of Matthew. There's a lot of words we should just bring back into common language. We should say behold more. I'm going to say behold more. Behold, it's twice here. There was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone, and then, catch this, sat on it. Sat on it. Just, I'm going to plop down here. I'm going to sit. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. So notice what's happened here. Notice what's taken place. A few verses before, we find out that a man came forward and And in a fulfillment of the prophetic word of Isaiah 53, that even though this suffering servant would be cast off and condemned, he would be, in his death, buried with the rich. And so Joseph of Arimathea shows up, and Matthew tells us this is exactly according to God's plan, which is saying something, because after all, if you'd been publicly executed in the most powerful and demonstrative way, that they don't usually just give the body back. But there's something going on here. Matthew says this is all according to plan. So he's buried into a new tomb, and then a massive stone, presumably unmovable without a crew, you couldn't do it right, inconspicuously, was rolled over. And the thing that signified, the thing that symbolized the permanence of Jesus' death, the thing that as if were to say, like, it's buried, it's done, it's over, became, notice, a prop. The angel sat on it, right? I think as if to say, like, ta-da! Now, I don't think this is an accident either. I even hear the language of Psalm 110, one of the most commonly quoted psalms amongst the New Testament writers, and it starts with this prophetic vision that David has of the Messiah that would come. Jesus has a debate about this with some of the scholars, and David prophetically sees into the future and says, the Lord says to my Lord, that is one that would come from him and will be a child, will be his Lord, which is weird, unless you're a helicopter parent, in which case your child is your Lord. That's not healthy, not sustainable. But he says that one will be a descendant and yet Lord. And that Lord will say, sit at my, or the Lord will say to my Lord, sit at my right hand until what? I make your enemies a footstool. The thing that symbolized doom and despair will now be an ottoman, right? It will be a prop. It will be literally prop your feet up, as it were, symbolically on your enemies. This is what God is going to intervene and do. And you see this here. I want you to be encouraged by this. Even practically for you in this room, as we consider that the resurrection has changed everything and can continue to change everything. The thing that you thought was destroying your life, God means to use as a prop in his work of saving it. Maybe the thing that you're most dreading, the things that you're most ashamed of, the things that cause the most sorrow and pain, I don't know how and I don't know when, but the resurrection presents to us that God is in the business of turning it into something glorious. And that's meant to be encouragement for us. After all, not 3 days before, the disciples had known nothing but excitement and victory. And in their mind, Jesus was winning. They're going to be in his cabinet in the new kingdom that he would bring. Their life is awesome. Everything was going to get great. And then everything that happened on Good Friday happened. Tragedy struck. But notice here, the tragic symbolic exclamation mark on what took place on Good Friday becomes something that the angel simply sits on. And it's powerful. It's amazing. Look at the next thing we see. The resurrection demonstrates the power of God over the powers of the world. Verse 3, it says, his appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. So stop for just a moment. This is not the first time this language has been used. Previously in Matthew's gospel, as he described what is called the transfiguration, Jesus goes up on the mountain with a couple of his disciples and appears to them like lightning. So join me in your imagination, a little bit of a thought of experiment. What's the closest you've ever been to a lightning strike? Go with me there for just a moment. What's the closest you've been to a lightning strike? Now, I have multiple, but I think that says more about me and kind of my folly, right, and recklessness than it says anything else. What were your emotions? What were your thoughts? How did you react? Now you get the picture. This is what happens. In verse 4, it says that lightning strike of an encounter causes fear to overwhelm the guards. They tremble. Again, I might ask the same question. When's the last time you've had so much fear you shook? They trembled, and it says then they became like dead men. Now, one of two things is happening here. Either one of them is plausible. They kind of point to the same thing. One, they were so shocked, they were so overwhelmed that they just passed out. They became unconscious. Or, it doesn't say that, it just says they became as if they were dead. They were so terrified, they became like a possum, and they were like, I'm just going to play like I'm dead. It's better. I think we have a better shot of acting like it already killed us, and maybe no one will notice. Either way, you get a kind of a picture of everything that's taking place. Something so terrifying, so powerful, reverses the story. And Matthew's telling us something amazing here. The one who was dead, weak, frail, and lifeless is now alive. And the ones at whose hands he died, with power and authority of the Roman government, are now dead. Right? You get this reversal, the power of God on display over the powers of the world. The one who is dead is now alive, and the ones who seem powerful and alive are as if they are dead. Again, see the encouragement. In the resurrection, God is inaugurating a great reversal. All the things that were true on Friday are becoming untrue one at a time. The one who was dead is alive, and those who are alive look dead. Think of it this way. The people who seem like they are winning don't. And the people who seem like they're losing don't. Friend, draw encouragement from this. Matthew wants us to remember that the resurrection is an emphatic crescendo to what God does. He confounds the wisdom of this world. His thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways. This shouldn't shock us. And yet in the resurrection, you see the inauguration of God's great reversal, which I think also serves an encouragement as well. The thing in your life that seems overwhelming, like it's winning, won't. And the places in your life where you think you are dead, places in your life that are full of despair, do not get the last word. Next, I think the resurrection gives us freedom then from fear. Now, this is common, but in verse 5, the angel, first thing he says to these people they encounter, and this, again, common, this is one of the most common phrases in the Bible, and it's especially common when angels show up, and you'll see it doesn't work. Do not be afraid, as if to say, I know what you're looking for. I know why you came here. I know you expected to see the body of Jesus. I know that's what you came, because after all, he was crucified, but here's the emphatic declaration. He's not here. He's risen. Not only is he risen, he's risen, he told you. He's risen just like he told you he would. In fact, come and see now. See where his dead body used to be. Come on in, see. And the resurrection gives us freedom from fear. I don't think I can overstate the significance of this particular part. If I were just to kind of step away and begin to just make observations, there might be no greater power or influence at work in cultures around the world today than fear. Now, some of it's deserved, as many of you might understand. Like, we've experienced more change in some of these weird social experiments that have been the history of the last 50 to 200 years. Even for many of you, like, if you think about it, just a smartphone has brought about more change, if you think of any of the things in history, than anything we can think of. We've experienced a lot of change, and in the uncertainty, people are terrified. I share this regularly. People are like, we are just a scratch under the surface from freaking out. Most people are one offense away from losing their mind. And I want you to know that's evidence of a few different things. The Apostle Paul speaks to Christians through Timothy later, and he says that's not from God. He says that God has not given us a spirit of fear, but God has given us power, love, self-control. I can't think of a more loud resurrection witness than a bunch of people who are simply not afraid. Now, to be fair, no one in the history of calming down has ever calmed down by being told to calm down. And I know many of you will be like, I doubt that. And they're going to try again. Doesn't work. But he says, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. And notice what we're invited to consider, that if the resurrection is true, if Jesus gets the last word over all these things, then as the eyes of faith are open towards it, here's what I'll tell you starts to happen. A little bit each day, a little bit each year, fear has a looser and looser grip on you and me. I can't think of a more helpful encouragement to people, even as I think about, like, man, probably the most rampant influence on even our partisan politics is fear. Fear. And I want to say, like, I dare you in your life to take the angel's words seriously here. He's not here. He's not here. He's risen. Let that begin to loosen the grip that fear has on your heart and mine. It's a complex kind of thing to consider because, after all, the Bible also commands us to have fear, that we are to fear the Lord, that we are to have awe and reverence for who God is and what God has done, and yet at the same time commanded not to fear. In light of that, think of it this way, that we have such awe and reverence for the resurrection power of Jesus that we have less reverence and awe for lesser things. The resurrection gives us that kind of freedom from fear, begins to loosen its grip on us. But here's the sparkle. The resurrection is God's pursuit of runaways and outcasts to welcome them as family. The angel says, go, tell his disciples he's risen from the dead. Behold, he's going before you. And there you will see him. See, I've told you. So they departed quickly from the tomb with, again, not listening. No one has ever calmed down in the history of calming down by being told to calm down. So they go with fear, but with fear and great joy. And they run to tell his disciples, verse 9, and behold, Jesus met them. They met them and said, greetings. Now, this is interesting. After this formal annunciation from the angel, this is, if you translate it more literally, this is a very colloquial, this is a more kind of lowbrow greeting. This isn't a formal annunciation or introduction. This is more like a, sup? Hey. I don't know how you greet people. That may not be helpful, but Jesus meets them just as he said, and the first thing he does is like, hey. What's up, guys? Now, this next phrase is hard for me to expound upon because it's hard for me to read without weeping. It says they came and they took hold of his feet and they worshiped him. I just, that resonates with me. I would desire, if Jesus walked in the room, I think that's what I would want to do. But look at the sparkle. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid, repeating the angel, repeating all of those encouragements and all the Bible. And then he says, go and tell my brothers. Go tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me. Go tell my brothers. Now, I want you to see the sparkle in this. Here's the sparkle. This is not how I would do it. Come and see here, and then realize the resurrection seals their adoption. It seals it. The Apostle Paul encourages a church like ours in Ephesians 1, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us in Christ with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places, even as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and blameless before him in love. He predestined us for adoption to himself as sons through Jesus Christ, according to the purpose of his will, to the praise of his glorious grace. This is not how I would respond. Right? After all, think of someone who's betrayed you. Think of someone who's disappointed you. Think of someone who's let you down. Yourself, of course, at the top of that list. Like, think of the people who have been incredible hurt to you. And now imagine what you would say to them in the first moment that you get to confront them. Right? Go tell those suckers. Right? Tell those treacherous betraying wastes of oxygen, right? Like, that's not just me. That's how I would say it. I'd let him sweat a little bit, right? Hey, go tell my brothers I'm coming. Tell my brothers I'll be there. I'll meet you. You get the idea? That's what I would do. But not Jesus. Look at the sparkle. He says, go and tell, not those suckers, those treacherous betrayers, go and tell my brothers, tell my sisters, I'm going to meet you. He says to the sinner, to the wanderer, and to the mourner, have no fear, brother. Have no fear, sister. You have nothing to fear. All that you might fear, I have disarmed. All on Good Friday that you might fear, death, rejection, condemnation, guilt, and abandonment, I've disarmed them all by taking them in myself. You have nothing to fear. He says to the sinner, to the wanderer, and to the mourner, have no fear. I'm not mad at you. I mean, just contemplate that for a moment, right? Like, think of the last movie you saw where someone comes back from the dead. It's usually not a good movie, right? It's usually when the undead come onto the scene, it's a pretty bad one, right? There's no like, oh, the undead are here. Oh, like that movie's not been made yet. Because after all, if you got to come back from the dead and go face to face with the people had played an active part in your death, what would you do? And notice Jesus says, tell my brothers, friend, for the sinner, the wanderer, and the mourner, he says, have no fear, I'm not mad. And maybe one of the best things that I could tell some of you upper Midwestern, right, religious people, and maybe you haven't actually let this settle in your own heart. You might be in your 60s and 70s and heard it your entire life, and yet you need to hear the good news. God of the universe is not mad at you because of Christ. Think of it this way. Because of Christ, God never punishes us. We will never be punished. I mean, we'll be disciplined like a good and loving parent. He'll discipline us. He'll shape us. He's making us to look like his son. After all, we're his brothers and sisters now. But friend, he's not mad. The wrath of God has been absorbed. Have no fear. He says to the sinner, to the wanderer and the mourner, have no fear. You're my family. You're my family. All that I have is yours. All that I inherit from the Father is now written into his will with your name on it. You are now co-inheritors. You will even reign alongside our brother Jesus forever and ever. He says to the sinner, to the wanderer, and to the mourner, have no fear. You have nothing to fear. I've disarmed everything that could assail you. I have absorbed all of the anger of God, and I have now sealed your adoption. He says, go. He says, tell them, I'm going to go ahead of them. I'm going to go ahead of them for my brothers and my sisters. I think of the language of the story of Jacob and Esau from the middle of the book of Genesis. The story of Jacob and Esau. Jacob, kind of a swindler, and Esau, kind of a self-righteous, and they hate each other. After all, Jacob kind of swindles him and steals his birthright, and then they go their separate ways, kind of experience their own couple of decades of living their own life, and then finally something happens. Jacob wrestles with God, gets a new name, because after all, when you encounter God, you're changed, and he becomes Israel, and so he's going back to, as it were, reconcile with his family and his brother, and so in an effort to reconcile with him, to hopefully appease his brother, who he's pretty sure, you know, after he's a big, strong, outdoorsy kind of a guy, Jacob is not. He's the other side of that. And so he sends out his possessions. He sends out his flocks, his cattle, and he sends out ahead to greet Esau on the way. And Esau passes and is like, what's this? What's happening? And then he starts sending his servants, and then he starts sending out, you know, kind of in ascending importance, he sends out his children. And even he sends out his own wives ahead until finally Esau runs up to him. They meet each other, and Esau greets him. It says they embrace and they weep. It says that Esau wept on his neck. Now, this is supernatural. Anytime you see one man and his face touching another man and his face, you're seeing something impressive. That's sacred space for men. And yet we find they embrace. Why? He says, they're brothers. And he says, what is this that you're sending ahead of me? Tell me all this that you're sending ahead, right? And Jacob explains, like, I thought you were going to be angry, and so I sent all these things ahead. You can hear it. Like, it's as if Jesus tells them, go, and you'll find that I'm already ahead of you. I'll meet them there. You can think of the story of Joseph meeting with his brothers who have betrayed him and sold him into slavery. And God blesses them. They leave him for dead. He gets sold off into slavery, but God blesses him, and he works his way up to be the second in command in the greatest empire of the world at that time, that is Egypt. And he's in charge with helping these people make it through a famine. And in the midst of this famine, his brothers, those who had betrayed him and left him off for dead, show up and they're in need. And he has the opportunity to exact vengeance. And we find, I think it's in Genesis 45, he comes to them and he says, "It's me. It's Joseph, your brother." God sent, as it were, his son ahead of us. We were helpless. Here's the sparkle. His plans for us are not contingent upon our ups and downs, but upon his faithfulness. Even when we were dead in our trespasses, he made us alive together with him. God has sent his son ahead of us, and he doesn't even make them sweat. I love it. Kind of like the lost son, the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. He runs back to confess his sin to the father, hoping the father might take him back. And before he can even finish his confession, the father silences him, embraces him, right? Think of it this way. Before the son can even justify himself, he's welcomed. And also here, before the disciples can even justify themselves, he shows that he has justified them for them. Doesn't make them sweat. Doesn't even make them explain or justify themselves. He welcomes with the justification he freely gives. So, last couple of things I want us to see here. The resurrection is an invitation to life beyond the limits of human explanation. Notice in verse 11 begins what must have been as Matthew wrote this, kind of the, as it were, kind of the rumor that was circulating. People would rather have another kind of explanation. I don't think this should surprise any of us. And so here's what I would tell you. If you're in this room and maybe you're not a Christian, maybe you wouldn't call yourself a believer in Jesus, you're not sure, you're wondering about this Jesus thing, I'm so grateful that you're here. In many ways, we exist because of you, and I'm so grateful. I hope you feel welcomed here. And especially if you're skeptical about the supernatural claims of Jesus, join the club. I want you to know, the Gospel of Matthew is very honest, and he speaks to the skeptics. One of the ways I think you can trust this account can be found even in the first few verses. The first witnesses that each one of the Gospel writers trusts in are women. Now, I'm not endorsing this kind of a structure, but in the first century, a very paternalistic society, women were not even allowed to testify in courts of law. Their eyewitness testimony was not admissible. And so, if you were going to start a legend, if you were going to start a movement based on the eyewitness testimony of a couple people, the last people you would pick are the people whose testimony aren't even admissible. And so it must have been the case, I argue, that this is what happened. You wouldn't say that the women here were the first eyewitnesses unless they actually were. Also, for Matthew, these people were still alive, as if to say, yeah, go talk to them. And so if you come with a lot of skepticism and questions and doubts, welcome. Notice, starting in verse 11, people would rather have another explanation. It said that there was a rumor that behind closed doors, they look, let's don't let this happen. Let's don't let this kind of a rumor get out. Instead, let's start our own story that, no, this is what happened. His body was stolen. And notice, the fear of these women and the skepticism that you might bring is related. Because after all, whenever you begin to trust that there is something supernatural, it's a threat to your control, is it not? It bursts your categories, all of them. It defies human explanation. And so if you come with questions, jump in here. Matthew welcomes them. He says, you're not alone. Matthew makes it clear, no one expected this. Even we'll see in next week's passage, some who even saw Jesus doubted. And so I'll pose to you a statement that I'll come back to even next week. But here's how I would say it. Fill in the blank. I will believe Jesus is alive if. He invites our skepticism. He invites our doubts. And so fill in the blank with your doubts. I will believe Jesus is alive if, fill in the blank. And friend, be honest. That kind of honesty, again, is welcome here. I will believe Jesus is alive if. And I want to tell you something, even if in this room and this morning you're not a Christian, there's something wise and helpful that I would commend to you that this story brings out. I will believe in Jesus. I will believe Jesus is alive if. And I want you to know on the other side of that if is the thing that you most highly trust in and believe in your life. Fill in the blank with me. I will believe Jesus is alive if. And whatever is on the other side of that if and in that blank, let the wisdom of this text kind of inform you. Whatever's on the other side of that if is what you trust in and worship, even though you would never use that word, you hope in. I'll give you mine and my own skepticism and doubt. I'll believe Jesus is alive if I can explain it. If I can explain it. Now, that shouldn't shock any of you. I spend most of my time once a week standing up here explaining things. So it stands to reason that I would put too much confidence in that, right? It stands to reason I would be tempted to only trust in that which I can explain. But friend, fill in the blank. And see it as just a good thing to know about yourself. The resurrection is God's gift to you to expose what you actually love, what you actually trust in, what you actually hope in day to day. You may not bow down to it, but you trust in it more than anything else. Maybe you do enshrine it. You park it in a garage or you pay bills on it, right? But see it like this. If I say, Jesus is alive, and there's a part of you that says, so what? That part is your master. That part is what your life is currently built around. See if I can illustrate that better. If I say, like the angel, if I say, he's not here, he's risen, he's alive. If you find yourself, so what, saying something like, so what, I'm still lonely, right? Or, so what, I still hate my job. Or, so what, I'm still in despair over the, just know that thing has power and control over your life. And let the wisdom of this text begin to show that. Let it confront your own skepticism. I quote this regularly on an Easter Sunday, but a history professor at Yale says it this way. He says, the more that one examines the various factors which seem to account for the extraordinary victory of Christianity, the more one is driven to search for a cause underlying them all. It is clear that at the very beginning of Christianity, there must have occurred a vast release of energy virtually unequaled in history. Let me read that again. At the very beginning of Christianity, there must have occurred a vast release of energy virtually unequaled in history. I love how close he gets to it, right? He's like, something large must have happened, right? Something significant must have happened. He's a historian, and so he's speaking then of every single great movement, political, religious, or otherwise, is always accompanied with great political power, with great military power, with some like turning of a technology, right? There's some sort of great movement, or every great movement comes with some sort of power or energy. And he lists out some of those, like political, military, you name it. He says, nothing else could explain the surge of the early Christian movement. What caused this release of energy lies outside the realm in which modern historians are supposed to move. As if to say, as a historian, whatever caused it, I'm really not within my sphere of influence, my discipline to say. Friend, come with your skepticism. Something happened. Something changed everything. And it's an invitation to believe that there are things that exist beyond your explanation. Lastly, what does this story tell us about God? What does the resurrection of Jesus tell us about humanity, about even existence in the world? Here's what I would commend to you. The resurrection is God's commentary and verdict on Good Friday. What does this tell us? It's not just some great miracle. We've seen those. Jesus has done those. They're even in the rest of the Old Testament. Instead, it is as if this is something else. It is a turning point. All that is true on Good Friday is being reversed on Resurrection Sunday. Let me try to explain it in a couple of different ways. I'll give you two maybe analogies and then commend to you something to reflect. The majority of the time, and we saw this even a little bit ago, the majority of the time, the Bible describes our slavery to sin or debt to sin in those categories. The language of slavery, bondage, imprisonment, or debt, something we owe that we cannot pay. So think of it this way. Good Friday, as it were, as if Jesus went to the bank to which you and I owed an unpayable debt and paid it off. But Resurrection Sunday, he ripped the door off the vault. Think of it as Good Friday, Jesus broke into the prison that sin had you and I in and set all of the captives free. But on Easter Sunday, he knocked down all the doors and all the walls. It's not just that these things happen. It's as if to say, these things will never have power ever again. It was enough that Jesus had done one thing or another on Good Friday, but the resurrection reverses all that was true on Good Friday. The cross seems to annul Jesus as Messiah and King and his abandonment, weakness. And yet the resurrection confirms his kingship. This is an inexplicable event. And the story is credible because God is credible. The point in which the greatest tragedy ever written becomes victory. The resurrection is God's verdict over all that was true on Good Friday. Friend, go back there with me. Go back. Several hours ago, right before dawn, some 2,000 years ago, go back with me to that tomb. Hear God's verdict over sin as Jesus begins to experience blood pumping again through his veins. Hear God's verdict over hell when his lungs started to fill with air again. Hear God's verdict over Satan when his eyes that had been dehydrated at this point began to miraculously fill with fluid again and he opened his eyes to see. Hear God's verdict over shame and condemnation as consciousness is restored and he begins to know life to never know death again. For those who believe, I want to tell you something. In a moment, we will celebrate something Christians have done. We will be invited to the Lord's table to celebrate communion, that is the Lord's Supper. And something miraculous will be declared to you. He's right back there. He's gone ahead of you. And he's waiting for you. Not with vengeance. Not with anger. But with himself. And so just a moment, we'll respond in faith by meeting Jesus at a table. And I want to clarify that for you. If you're in this room and you're not a Christian, then I want to tell you that we meet at the Lord's table as those who are repenting, baptized believers in Jesus. So if that's not you, then friend, accept the invitation. Scan that QR code. We would love to, you'll see there where you can ask more about what it means to be a Christian or to be baptized. We would love to tell you more about that. And for you this morning, it isn't to meet Jesus at the table, it's to meet Jesus at the empty tomb. He'll receive you. He won't cast you out. But for the rest of us, a miracle awaits us. He's gone ahead. He's gone ahead of us. Not to wait with us with wrath and fury. He's already absorbed and defanged all of those things. For those who believe, something strange happens. You go to meet him and you find that he's been waiting for you, just as he said. And someone declares to you a mystery, the body of Christ sufficiently broken for you. The blood of Christ poured out for you. Finished, completed, so that now all that was true on Good Friday is undone. All the work of that ancient snake to bite the heel of Jesus is reversed as he crushes the head of that serpent. And we meet Jesus at a table where we feast in his welcome. Let's pray together as we prepare to respond in faith. God, thank you that you have done for us what we could not do for ourselves. Thank you that what stands on Good Friday as tragedy and awfulness does not get the last word. So I pray, Lord, that for those in this room, maybe they wouldn't call themselves a Christian or they're not sure, would today you, by the power of your grace, begin to open their imagination? Might even at the very least they begin to long for this to be true? To be curious about what it is that has changed the world? Might you begin to allow us to consider the possibility that what took place here and what Matthew tells us changes everything. For the rest of us, maybe we've heard this story before. Might you renew us with it? Might you encourage us with it? Might we even contemplate the barriers, the fears, the things that hold us back, that seem to hold us down? Might we consider the truth of the resurrection that encourages us every single day? Those things do not get the last word. Cancer doesn't get the last word. Death doesn't get the last word. Tragedy and suffering, injustice, none of these things get the last word. And so we thank you for the gift of the resurrection that gives us hope and encouragement today, fuels and changes everything, reverses all that was done on Good Friday. We thank you and ask that we would receive now that by faith. In Jesus' name, amen.